It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We welcome acclaimed astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson is here as we explore what Hollywood gets right and wrong with science. And is there really life out there? Join our conversation by calling in with your questions at any point, 800-642-1234. Neil deGrasse Tyson directs New York City's Hayden Planetarium, is a research associate of the Department of Astrophysics at the American Museum of Natural History. Neil, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me back.
So you give a talk later this month at the Pabst Theater in Milwaukee. It's called An Astrophysicist Goes to the Movies, the sequel. Does your scientific expertise keep ruining a lot of movies for you?
Well, so no, I just observe it. I don't invest emotion in it.
This isn't impacting your mental health.
Yeah, no, I'm very stable on all of these grounds here. I think often what I do is misunderstood, because I just think about it. If you go to a film, you watch a film with someone, let's say, who they're a car expert, and there's a period piece taking place, let's say, in the 1958, let's say, and then there's a 1962 Chevy Bel Air parked in the street. Your friend will say, "That doesn't belong there. That car wasn't but another 4 years." You say, "Hey, you know your cars," and that person would get complimented by you. Or if it's some Jane Austen period piece, right, and someone gets off their carriage in the English countryside, and they're wearing a top hat instead of a derby. If you had a friend who knew about costumes and said, "No, that needs to be a derby. The top hat didn't come in for another 15 years," you'd say, "Hey." And there I am pointing out sort of science flaws. By the way, I also point out where they got science right. So just to be clear, but I point this out and people say, "Well, it's just a movie. You're ruining it for us." And I think that's unfair. That's all.
Yeah, just, wearing science on your sleeve, that's okay. But what harm is there to just go along with it? I mean, when screenwriters and directors bend the truth a bit on the science in order to make their story work, and you are really, you feel a lot of heart for artists, capital A in art, and, shouldn't they be allowed some latitude?
Yeah, oh, of course. So my motto here, my operational intent flows from a quote from Mark Twain, where he said, "First get your facts straight, then distort them at your leisure." Okay. So that's kind of what I want. So don't ignore science that could have told a better story just because you didn't know the science. Bring a scientist on to offer comments. And then you say, "Hey, that's good. Was that what would happen to you near a black hole?" That's way better than anything the screenwriter is going to imagine is going to happen to you. And so I'm particularly particularly observant if you put a science bit in a storyline that's just flat out wrong and you think you're telling a better story and you're not. I'm going to call you out on that.
We are talking about what Hollywood gets wrong and right about science and physics. We have Neil deGrasse Tyson here, directs New York City's Hayden Planetarium. You can join in along the way about science, questions on your mind, movies that have made you think differently about science. 800-642-1234. You said the 1999 film The Matrix and the 97 film Contact are two of your favorite science fiction films. What sets these two apart?
Well, Contact was just had very good authentic science in it. Of course, it's based on a novel written by Carl Sagan. So it's got very good starting points. Whatever liberties would then be taken, I was perfectly content with that. What I especially liked about Contact was how the public was authentically represented in how they might react to this information that we made actual contact with aliens, intelligent aliens on another planet. And these not just, antennaed aliens walking around Earth. No, this is like contact through telescopes and they send us information how to build a ship to go visit them. So it's very deeply thought out. So I give it very high marks on this. The Matrix, it's my favorite movie. That's all. Just pure. Just whoa. You know, by the way, there's one flaw in the Matrix, but I'm going to give them a hall pass because there is no movie without that one flaw. So I said, okay, I'm with you here. All right. Can I tell you what the flaw is?
You okay, can. Indulge yeah. yourself. Yes, please.
Okay. So the machines are harvesting people to draw energy from our bodies because we generate about 100 watts of power. All right. Just being alive. Anywhere between 60 and 100 watts. So the machines found out that they can use us as like a battery, as a source of energy to drive their entire matrix. And so, but then they found out that we were better at this if they infused in our brains a world where we thought we were just living happily, paying our rent, buying groceries, and it's all happening in our head. And so here's this human farm where everybody's living out a world. And well, then how do you feed the humans? Well, they find some way to feed them. They will take dead humans and feed them to the living humans. Okay, fine. Here's the problem. Whatever energy source you're giving to the humans, just use that energy source. Why give it to the humans? You're not going to get more energy out of the humans that you're putting into them, because that's not how thermodynamics works. So that's just a flaw, but there wouldn't be a movie without it. So I say, okay, Wachowskis, I'm giving you this one. And because so much else was very consistently and deeply thought out. And by the way, the whole Geekiverse, the entire universe of people who think and care about storylines and their internal consistencies, what we'll care more about is that you are consistent with your own ideas within the story, whether or not they match the science.
Well,
by the way, it's not just science fiction. In my talk, there's scenes from A Bug's Life that are remarkably scientifically accurate. And not the fact that you have bipedal walking ants that have only four limbs. No, but there's some physics in A Bug's Life that's like, oh my gosh, they use surface tension on liquids. A mosquito comes up to a bar and orders a drink. And if you're a mosquito, what drink would you order?
Oh, goodness. Blood, obviously.
No. Bloody Mary. It's a
Bloody
bar.
Mary.
Please. Okay. Just be get real here.
Okay? Yes. Okay. I'm following.
Duh.
Yes.
Right. So orders a. Okay. So then the bartender serves the drink. And did they serve it in a glass or receptacle? No. They just plunked it down as this little blob of liquid. Because when you're as tiny as a mosquito, what's called surface tension on liquids maintains the shape, like the beads of water on a freshly waxed car. That water doesn't just spill. It beads up. And that's all you need if you're going to feed a mosquito. And then the mosquito sticks its proboscis, whatever that is, in the liquid, and it sucks it, and that's the drink. That was brilliant. Brilliant. So half of what I talk about is brilliant invocations of science when you didn't otherwise expect it.
We have astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, who directs New York City's Hayden Planetarium, coming to Wisconsin later this month. And you can call in with your questions, your thoughts anytime, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson will be in Milwaukee this month discussing what Hollywood gets right and wrong with science. And he's spent his career studying the stars, space, and our place in the universe. Join in all things science, your questions, your movie observations, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Jim in Spring Green. Jim, hi. What would you like to ask?
I'd like Dr. Tyson to give me his opinion as to or not he believes that we actually have free will. The reason I ask that, I think that we do not. I think we are just we're just able to respond based on our conditioning, whether it's genetic or socialization and so forth, and experience, and it just comes out of just like our brain has been Googled.
Jim, thank you. What are your thoughts, Neil, there on free will?
There's a lot of conversation, especially in recent years, about whether we have free will or not. I've heard people who are full proponents of it give what comes across as a very convincing argument, especially a neuroscientist, where you will behave, you will act, and what you think is your conscious decision was actually pre-decided inside your brain before you were consciously aware of it. That's a little scary, actually, to realize that this is true. However, broadly speaking, whether or not we have what would be strictly called free will, the perception of free will, I think, is fundamental to a free society, to what you might choose for your career, how you might behave. The day we say, I don't have free will, therefore, when I rob a bank, I was not in control, I'm not accepting that excuse, okay? I'm going to say, no, you did have a choice. And so operationally, we function as though we have free will, and I'm happy with that. And otherwise, you'll say, this is my lot in life and nothing can change it. The evidence doesn't really support that. People have changed their life if things were not going well. People have messed up their lives, by making bad decisions. So I'm okay with free will.
Science becoming such a political issue, as you know, these debates are raging around the validity of vaccines, around face masks and COVID. How are vaccines depicted in movies?
Oh, I just saw, thanks for asking, just like yesterday, I just saw the 1971 version of I Am Legend, which was called The Omega Man. Mm. That was a book, I Am Legend, written in the 1950s, Omega Man, with Charlton Heston, who is a military doctor who developed a vaccine for some kind of virus that actually killed most of the people in the world. And half the film was his effort to try to save the lives of these people who were sick but hadn't yet died, or keeping alive the people who happened to have some immunity. It's all about vaccines. And I'm reminded, oh, that was when people embraced vaccines. Right? Oh, there's a whole other era, right? And of course, the more modern version of that film, I Am Legend, with Will Smith, that was a full celebration of his research and what was required to protect a living population of people from a disease. So anytime I've seen vaccines in film, that is the light in which it is presented.
There have been,
understandably so, because that's how that is the value of vaccines to our health and survival.
Right, and certainly the outbreaks of viruses, a plot line through time. And now that we have such relatable experience with that in the pandemic, what perspective can you offer as we look at these plot lines and look at the science in them?
Well, what I wonder is, of course, those plot lines, it wasn't, the lethality of the diseases represented in those films was huge, much mm-hmm. higher than anything we have seen, right? That's why they're science fiction. You take stories and take them to their limits and see how people respond and react. But you could ask, what lethality level would COVID had to have been for people to not break out in enclaves and say, I don't trust vaccines, I don't want, and meanwhile, it's on its way into a community, and if it kills 90% of them, I'm thinking everybody would have lined up for the vaccine. But also we had this fascinating variation in people's responses to COVID based on your age and what your preconditions were, right? So that was not completely obvious at the beginning of the pandemic, how that would shake out. And this, as the data roll in, I think it's the responsibility of agencies and of people tasked with maintaining our health and well-being to have sort of this rolling way that we can update our understanding of what the vaccine is doing and what the virus is doing, right? And I don't know that it was done that transparently in the early parts. Plus, people think that a scientist makes a statement, and if it's different later, then you can't trust scientists, without realizing that the moving frontier of any research is susceptible to new research. That's the whole, that's what distinguishes science from everything else.
Mm-hmm.
To say, you said something different last year than this year. Yeah, because we know more now. Yeah, that should be celebrated, not rejected.
Let's go to Anne in Watertown. Anne, hi, go ahead.
Hi, yeah, along those lines, I'm just wondering how we can deal with the problem of legislators making decisions about science, completely avoiding the people who are trained in that subject.
When you're saying, like, lawmakers who don't have a scientific background passing legislation to regulate how science is taught, is that what you're getting at, Anne?
No, not being taught, but just, you know, how the legislature, I mean, here in Wisconsin, has said, well, no, we have to make this decision. We will not let the scientists that are hired by our agencies who were established by a law, a statute, you know, that we know better than them. You know, this is sort of weird, you know.
Neil, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's a very important question. If I go back in time just a bit, in fact, go back exactly 100 years, in 100 years, no, 180 years, the Abraham Lincoln in 1863, realizing that our relatively new country could benefit from scientific advice, science that had helped shape modern Europe, he signed into law the National Academy of Sciences, whose job it is to collect and collate the best available science to advise Congress and the executive branch on what might be necessary when they create legislation. And since then, we've had many other science agencies, the Department of Energy, NASA, CDC, the National Institutes of Health. And if you do not heed their advice, you can ask, well, whose advice are you going to heed? When you hire a plumber, well, I guess you could fix all your pipes in your house, but you're probably going to hire a plumber because they know about plumbing in ways that you don't. That's kind of how that works. Oh, and by the way, science is not the testimony of any one individual. It is whatever is the result you're presenting. Has it been verified by peers, peer review? Because otherwise you end up cherry picking one research result or another to fit your philosophy, your religion, your politics, your culture. And that is not how science works. And so yes, if a politician is not obeying science and you think they should, vote for a different politician. It's that simple.
Talking with Neil deGrasse Tyson, who directs New York City's Hayden Planetarium. You can join in at 800-642-1234. So what are the odds of life on other planets as we look out there and look up to the stars?
Well, it's highly likely. Anyone who's studied the question, because you look at life on Earth, what are we made of? You know, hydrogen and oxygen and carbon and nitrogen, those four ingredients are our top four ingredients. Those are the most common chemically active ingredients in the universe. So life on Earth was highly opportunistic when the molecules assembled. That's A. B, life formed almost as fast as it possibly could have. It took about 100 million years, which sounds like a long time, but in the life of the Earth, that's short. And the universe is old. The universe is, and so you combine those three and you say, there's nothing, shouldn't be, no, we don't have no reason to expect our corner of the universe to be special. And so anyone who's studied the problem, it feels quite positive about those likelihoods. And this is a big search branch of NASA's interest. Mm-hmm. In when we send rovers to planet, we're looking for organic molecules. We're looking for water, something fundamental to life as we know it. Yeah.
Neil, thank you for joining us.
I'm delighted. Thanks for all the curiosity of the, and I can't wait to visit Wisconsin. I'm all in on that. The end of the month.
Neil deGrasse Tyson will speak on February 24th at Pabst Theater in Milwaukee. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new survey of students in the University of Wisconsin system has added fuel to the debate over free speech on college campuses. But the debate has been happening for years. Students, professors, and college administrators all face decisions about what speech should be protected and how. Rich Kramer reports.
Days after former Republican President Donald Trump's 2016 victory, conservative commentator Ben Shapiro stepped to the podium in a crowded UW-Madison lecture hall.
Please join me in welcoming Mr. Ben Shapiro.
Shapiro mocked around 20 protesters in the room he deemed social justice warriors. The group responded by periodically interrupting his presentation. The protesters' disruption of the event would become a flashpoint in a national battle over free speech on campus. In 2017, Wisconsin Republicans introduced a bill mandating punishments up to expulsion for UW students who repeatedly disrupt free speech on campus. That legislation never made it to the desk of then-Governor Scott Walker, but the UW System Board of Regents was then made up almost entirely of Republican appointees. They passed a resolution that mirrored some of the bill's language. Former UW System President Ray Cross headed the state's universities at the time.
What I think the Shapiro incident may have triggered is an exposure of one of the flaws that I felt we had in our policy.
Cross says the university does want to protect speakers against what's known as the heckler's veto. That's when the loudest voices are allowed to shut down views they reject. The debate over what free speech on campus should look like is messy. A survey of more than 10,000 UW System students released this month found around half of respondents believed speakers should be disinvited from campus if some find their message offensive. It also found conservative students were more likely to feel pressure to self-censor in class.
I thought that it's at least a good first step.
That's UW-Madison student Jake Rivard. He took the survey. He calls himself a free speech absolutist and chairs the campus chapter of conservative group Young America's Foundation, which invited Shapiro in 2016. Last fall, YAF invited nationally known conservative author Matt Walsh to campus to screen his documentary titled What is a Woman?, which is critical of transgender identity and medical care. Rivard says the event sold out with hundreds more trying to get in.
What it tells me on the surface is that people are interested, at least to hear what he has to say, even if they don't, you know, agree with everything. I don't agree with everything that Matt says, but there's a part of what he says that, you know, I can get behind and I can support.
Ahead of Walsh's event, the student union was vandalized with spray-painted messages calling him a pedophile and Nazi. About 100 protesters rallied outside the event, including PhD candidate Caitlin Benedetto, who argues Walsh's rhetoric ignores growing hostility toward transgender people.
He's signaling and perhaps fomenting even more suspicion and even violence towards trans people.
The protests did not disrupt the event itself. Everyone supports the broad concept of free speech, but sometimes the blinders go on, says Joe Cohn with the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, or FIRE. The national group has represented students, professors, and campus newspapers in lawsuits against university speech policies.
And if we lose the ability to kind of grapple with the uncomfortable conversations, even the ugliness of some views that might be out there in the world, we're going to have a much harder time as a society grappling with those issues when those students become the people in power.
The debate over free speech on campus is far from settled in Wisconsin, and the recent student survey results mark a new chapter as Republican legislators craft the state's next budget. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about motivational self-talk and what has a positive effect on elite athletic performance, the mindset players take to help cope with high-pressure situations. Think Super Bowl Sunday. Join in by calling with your questions about the mind during demanding and intense competition. Share your observations, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Brian Zulager is a sports psychology professor in the School of Kinesiology and Health Sciences at Adams State University in Colorado, and a Wisconsin native, I should add. Brian, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Morning, and thank you.
Good morning. So walk us through this. How do elite athletes mentally prepare for high-stakes competitions?
Yeah, and you said you mentioned high pressure and those kind of environments, and a big piece of that is mentally preparing for that. And I think for a lot of cases and for a lot of people, we tend to think about downplaying pressure, or that pressure is kind of a bad thing. And to perform at a high level in these kind of environments, we have to sort of normalize pressure. And the way we do that is to not downplay it, but to actually play it up and then mentally get ourselves ready for what that's going to take. And that can look in a lot of different ways, but pressure training, specifically training yourself to handle pressure, is something that has to happen in practice for these athletes. And the coaches have to design and work with them to try to simulate the environments they're going to face, kind of thing. Now, obviously you can't simulate something like the Super Bowl. That's a unique thing, and it's a big thing. But we work with athletes to try to help them mentally prepare for that through various different things. Visualization is a simple skill that we can practice and utilize to get our bodies and minds sort of ready for what they're going to face.
You talk about visualization, and, you know, we've heard of that. Visualize yourself before you go in front of the audience. Can anybody improve on being mentally motivated during training and practice through these techniques?
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that I think a lot of times we tend to think of, an athlete's struggling, or maybe they've got a big competition like Super Bowl, for example, coming up. And so they might think, okay, I'm going to, try to get myself ready now. But it's something that anybody can benefit from. We work with people from youth levels to elite levels, and we work outside of sport with performers outside of sport as well. And so anybody really that's in a performance environment is going to be able to benefit from working on mental training, working on things like visualization. You mentioned self-talk. The conversation that we have with ourselves in our head is very crucial to our ability to be present and be focused and to maintain composure in these kind of environments, so that we can, be at our best.
What role do rituals or superstitions have in preparation and anticipation of a big event?
Yeah, so these are common things in sport, and anybody that's played or participated in sport has probably seen it or maybe even had one themselves. what I liken this to is sort of it's mental training, but sort of without any guidance in a way, right? Mm-hmm. We develop these things, or maybe we did something a certain way and then we got the outcome we wanted. Say we won the game or something like that. So we're like, oh, that must have helped. I'm going to do that again. And it's a form of mental training, but it's sort of like if you let somebody in the weight room and they had no idea what any of the lifts were, and they were just kind of walking around doing different exercises, right? And this kind of happens with our mind, right? Because we're thinking all the time, but maybe we haven't been guided by a mental performance coach or somebody with a background to understand the best practices in mental training. And that's where sort of, rituals or, superstitions kind of form, in my opinion. And we do a version of that, but it's guided and it's more intentional. And the key piece to it is that you don't want it to be something where it's like you have to do it in order for it to work necessarily, kind of thing, because then we've sort of created this all or nothing concept in her mind. And that's a lot of times where people are with superstition. Like, if I don't put my lucky socks on, then I'm not going to be in the right headspace to perform well, kind of thing. And maybe you forget your lucky socks, right? So then what are you going to do? You have to be able to be psychologically flexible, to be resilient, to be able to kind of adapt to these situations. And this is a key aspect of performing under pressure as well, because we tend to think that things are going to go perfectly or that they're going to go well on game day or competition day. And very rarely does that everything go perfectly, if ever. And so it's sort of preparing for that. Hey, so there's going to be mistakes. There's going to be things that happen at times. And I've got to be ready to respond to that.
I want to talk about coaching talk with you. And I don't know how you feel about Apple TV's Ted Lasso, but I want to play a clip. And, you know, Jason Sudeikis plays this American football coach hired to manage a British soccer team. So here's Sudeikis in one of his famed locker room speeches.
Most of the time, change is a good thing. I think that's what it's all about. Embracing change. Being brave. Doing whatever you have to so that everyone in your life can move forward with theirs. Maybe it's the only way you can truly help her be happy. Obviously, by her, I'm referring to Lady Football.
So tell us a little bit about the effects of positive coaching on elite athletes.
Yeah, so it's a great show, and it's a good show. I do like it. It's one that I always got asked if I had watched it, and I was quite behind on watching it, but I'm caught up now.
Are you up to speed? Okay.
I am. Yeah. We had a daughter in the last year, and so I had a lot of time where I was sitting around while she was napping or sleeping or something like that, sometimes on my chest. So I was watching Ted Lasso and getting caught up on that. So yeah. So anyway, it's great. And it's really unlocking what's possible for people. And when we care about people, we genuinely care about people, and they know that we care about them, that frees them up psychologically to be able to go try to be the best they can be. And that's ultimately all we can control. We can't control if we win or lose, but we can control our effort, our preparation, and how we execute. We could do everything right, and the other team could do everything right, and maybe they're better that day, right? And positive coaching sets the foundation for that, to say, hey, we're going to get you to go out and be able to perform at your best, which is going to give you the best chance to win. But if you don't, we still love you and care about you, and you're still a good person. And, you know, there's other things that we can do. We can come back and train and look at ways to get better. And also just understanding that there's things beyond sport, right? And for every person, you know, that's going to stop at some point. And, you know, for the average high school kid, that doesn't go beyond high school, right? The average youth sport athlete, that doesn't go beyond high school. And so, for the bulk of people participating in sport, it's how can we have them have a better experience so that they enjoy it. It's more fun, it's more fulfilling, and they go on and, you know, maybe want to continue to be active or do that sport, but they do it recreationally or whatever it is, so that they can be healthy people and hopefully better people in society as well. Sport's a powerful platform. We're talking about the Super Bowl here. I mean, they got a whole week of media coverage for this thing. It's a big deal in society, right? And so people pay attention to it, and people are paying attention even at the youth levels, right? And so when people are paying attention, they learn. And so if coaches are teaching them the X's and O's, but also teaching them how to be better people, we've got a really powerful platform that we can make some positive change in society.
Sports psychologist Brian Zuliger, join in with your questions at any point on the psychology of sports. Share your experiences, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Yeah. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Sports psychologists give athletes the support they need when they need it to maintain peak performance and cope with the ups and downs of competition. Call in with your questions, your thoughts ahead of elite athletes performing in the Super Bowl this Sunday, 800-642-1234. We have Brian Zuliger, who's a sports psychology professor at Adams State University. Brian, we heard from Michael in Milwaukee, called in to say that they imagine that how much pressure a person or athlete feels must be affected by how confident they feel in themselves, as in more pressure with less confidence. How do those tensions work through, you know, work out there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's sort of what I was talking about earlier, in the sense that the more we can mentally prepare ourselves for whatever pressure we're going to face, that helps our ability to be confident in our ability to perform. And that's an important piece. But another aspect of confidence that we tend to not talk about as much is just sort of this idea of, am I confident in myself as a person, independent of the performance? And I think for a lot of people, in short, you know, we tend to be very self-critical. And for various reasons, we've learned in lots of different places in society that if we're self-critical, that that's going to help us be better, right? And it does, to a certain element, because we're sort of coaching ourselves with self-criticism. And, you know, and criticism doesn't have to be negative. It can be constructive in the sense of getting better. But it's the idea that if we're our own best friend, right, we give ourselves some self-compassion, we're more encouraging with that. It helps us be more accepting of who we are as a person. And then from there, let's go mentally prepare and try to get confident for this performance kind of thing. And if that's a good foundation, then it's easier and you're better able to handle going into those environments.
Some critical environments are social media. How are athletes being affected by the growth of social media and these platforms, especially over the past decade?
Yeah, it's definitely a big change. I mean, I was giving a talk just this past weekend at the Wisconsin Track and Field Coaches Clinic, and I talked about how when I was growing up, the way that you figured out, you know, how people did or how people performed was, you know, you read it in the paper the next day kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a few articles and then there was some, maybe some stat boxes and stuff like that, but that was pretty much it. And, you know, they barely covered the state championships on TV kind of thing. And now it's like, you know, every little competition is live streamed or, you know, all these kind of things. And they get the feedback very immediately, right? And because people can post and comment about them, people might have been posting and commenting about me, for example, when I was in high school, about how I played, but I didn't know it. There was no way for me to hear it unless they were literally telling it to me kind of thing, or somebody wrote about it in the paper, which was pretty rare, right? But mm-hmm. Nowadays you can make any kind of comment. There's stories, there's all sorts of coverage on that. And these athletes, if they're going on and consuming that, they're getting that feedback from society, from the fans, from the audience kind of thing as a performer immediately. And that can be really challenging to process and handle. And so we work with them to, the mental training just becomes even more important, in my opinion, because you have to be more resilient, you have to be more competent, you have to be mentally stronger to be able to navigate critical, immediate feedback from lots of different people, because we do care about what other people think to some extent. And no matter how much we try to train that, there's a certain element to that that you can't override, and it's just part of being human. And so, you know, different strategies like managing, you know, how much you consume it, all these kind of things are some things that we work with athletes on that.
Brian Zuliger, talking sports psychology, as a sports psychology professor at Adams State University in Colorado. So, Brian, you know, as you look at the Super Bowl here, you know, in 2019, the National Football League standardized counseling for teams, and licensed behavioral health clinicians spend about 8 to 12 hours a week at team facilities. You know, a sports psychologist is different, of course, from a mental health psychologist. How do you see mental health and, you know, and this aspect for athletes infiltrating areas of football and other sports?
Yeah, it's definitely growing and in a good way. Colleagues that are full-time in some of these positions and working with various NFL teams, and that's becoming more common, and it's becoming more common for them to have a licensed psychologist, as well as potentially it could be somebody who has a dual role in a way that has training in both sports psychology and counseling psychology, who's delivering those services. And sometimes there's people who are licensed counselors, and then there's also people like myself that are working with them in sort of the sports psychology, mental performance side of things as well. And so I think it's a good thing, and it's growing, and hopefully it becomes the norm. And really what we need to see and have happen is the trickle-down effect, like we see happen a lot of times with things where we see something come at the elite level and it works its way down to the lower levels, because we need youth athletes to be able to get access to mental performance coaches and mental training and getting their coaches educated on it and those kind of things, so that it's not that somebody waits until they're a pro athlete before they get access to somebody like myself kind of thing, because we can have a better impact on their experience well before that. And like I said earlier, not everybody makes it that far. Mm-hmm. Actually a very few amount of people make it that far. And so how can we get it to more people? And that's working its way down. And that's where I think the benefit of seeing it becoming more mainstream in places like the NFL, where a lot of people are paying attention and looking to and watching, is just going to help normalize down. That.
Brian, yeah. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Brian Zuliger, sports psychology professor at Adams State University in Colorado. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.